Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litvak, and I'll be your host. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Richard Bell about his book, Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home, published by Simon & Schuster in 2019. Dr. Bell is an associate professor of history at the University of Maryland, College Park. Stolen tells the true story of how five young black boys were kidnapped from Philadelphia in 1825. Dr. Bell recounts the boys' journey as they were forced to travel south into slavery. Those familiar with popular tales such as Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave, or more recent historiographical works like Erica Dunbar's Never Caught, will find Dr. Bell's Stolen to be a must-read, as he explores how one kidnapping was shaped by the larger history of slavery, the interstate slave trade, the law, and a host of other factors. Dr. Bell, welcome to the program.
Derek, thanks for having me.
All right. So I guess to get things kicked off, can you just give our listeners a general kind of feel of how you got interested in this project?
Oh, geez. Yeah. So this is a dark story. And I came to this subject matter via another dark story. My first book, which was published in 2012, was about suicide in America between the Revolution and the Civil War. And when you're writing a book about suicide and you're working on it for, a decade or so, people, friends and colleagues who know you're working on it, whenever they come across an historical suicide in their own research, they send me an email. So every couple of days, I get an email about a suicide in history that I probably wasn't aware of before. And if I thought it was relevant, I'd look into it. And one day in 2011, as I was wrapping up the book, I think it was already in production by that point. It was a bit late to be gathering new research. I got one of these emails from a friend who said, "Hey, have you heard of Patty Cannon?" And I said, "Who is Patty Cannon? I've never heard of Patty Cannon." And it turns out that she was a woman who lived on the eastern shore of Maryland near the Delaware line, who may or may not have committed suicide while in jail, arrested there on suspicion of murdering a fellow slave trader. It turns out she was a slave trader. So I began to dig into this case, and I realized a couple of things. Number one, that while I'd never heard of her, over on the eastern shore, even today, she's relatively well known. People out there know a good deal about her. If you go to the Museum of Eastern Shore History in Seaford out there, you can find a creepy animatronic sort of robot of Patty Cannon rocking back and forth in a rocking chair. And the visitors seem delighted by how horrible she is. And the second thing I learned was about her business dealings, that she had made her way in the world by being a part owner of a family business that trafficked in the illegal kidnapping into slavery of free black adults and children from the Eastern Shore, from Baltimore, from Philadelphia, from wherever free black children and adults could be lured. This was 2011, remember, and I didn't know much about this market for kidnapped free children at that point. I'd read Solomon Northup's account of being an adult kidnapped into slavery back in graduate school a long time ago, but the big movie starring Brad Pitt, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Lupita Nyong'o, Michael Fassbender, and so on, hadn't come out yet. I think it came out in 2012. So this idea that alongside the legal domestic slave trade, that there was another illegal trade of kidnapped free black adults and children into slavery wasn't something I'd spent a lot of time thinking about. But being confronted with the end-of-life decisions of one of these kidnappers, Patty Cannon, sent me down a research rabbit hole. And I started working on her full-time. I originally conceived the book, which is now Stolen, as a biography of Patty Cannon. And in the course of, 8 years of research and writing, that book project transformed so that the book we have now, Stolen, is a micro-history focused on a particular kidnapping episode in which Cannon is involved, but she's a fairly minor player. It's the kidnapping of 5 free black boys from the streets of Philadelphia in August 1825 by some of Patty Cannon's operatives, and their journey into slavery in the Deep South in Mississippi and Alabama, and the entirely unexpected series of events that follows that ordeal.
And kind of going off of that, you know, you've given us an idea of like who's kind of involved in this kind of, you know, enterprise. And you call this the Reverse Underground Railroad, something that we talk about sometimes in history. And so for listeners and readers, potential readers who might not be as familiar with this, what is the Reverse Underground Railroad? And besides, you know, this one person that you're talking about, what's the kind of general, you know, identity of people who are participating in it that you found?
Yeah, it's a great question. So you're right. So this term, Reverse Underground Railroad, this is a term which I am not the first person to coin or come up with. If you Google it, you'll find lots of hits for it on the internet. But it's not a term that's in wide usage, or at least not yet. And I'm using it to refer to the traffic, the market for free black people who can be kidnapped into slavery. So we could say that Solomon Northup was a coerced rider on the Reverse Underground Railroad. We could say that the 5 boys at the heart of my book were coerced riders on this Reverse Underground Railroad. These are free black people, sometimes adults, though more usually children, abducted by professional human traffickers, often trafficked long distances from places like Philadelphia to places like Mississippi, usually on foot, by the way, in what we call coffles or caravans of marching, shackled human beings, and tried with the intent that traders, traffickers can sell them off to planters setting up in the new cotton kingdom in places like Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana in the first 6 decades of the 19th century to pass them off as legally traded slaves, either to planters who don't know better or to planters more likely who do not care the exact origin and legal status of the people they're buying in the Deep South. So one of the many arguments I'm making in Stolen, though Stolen is driven by a narrative, by a story, one of the many arguments I'm making is that this criminal traffic, this black market in black people was enormous. That by my estimates, and they have to be estimates because we're talking about unlawful criminal activity that doesn't always leave traces, by my estimates, we're talking about hundreds of people, adults and more normally children, kidnapped into slavery in almost every year in the 6 decades between 1800 and the outbreak of the Civil War, with a particular density of abductions after the end of the War of 1812 in the 1820s and the 1830s. So cumulatively, we're talking about thousands, if not tens of thousands, perhaps, of people kidnapped into slavery in the course of this half century. And the people doing the kidnapping, we should not think of these people as being particularly elite. They were usually people from poor, middling backgrounds who were opportunists, who were hawks, who were mercenaries. Most of them were white, obviously, these kidnappers, I mean, though some of the larger gangs, and I'm writing in Stolen about the largest gang and most fearsome gang in the United States, the gang led by Patty Cannon and her son-in-law, Joseph Johnson. This particular gang, one of its distinctive features was it would hire a couple of down-on-their-luck African-American men to actually be their frontline operatives, their frontline agents, the people who sidle up to free black boys down by the dock in Philadelphia in 1825 and offer them a quarter dollar for coming with them a few blocks out of town to help them unload some boxes from a schooner tied up near the banks of the Delaware River. So it's a particularly confusing, confounding, unsettling story about the way these agents of the slave power drive a wedge between different members of the African-American community.
And when thinking about just the sheer scale of what's going on here, you know, we kind of come to the conclusion that for free black people, particularly in the North, you know, the fear of kidnapping is something that they're always kind of, it's always in their mind. And one thing that that comes to mind when you always have that in the back of your mind is that, okay, if this happens, this is where I have to turn. This is what I have to do. And so in your research, where did you find that black family members who have had someone who was kidnapped, where did they turn? What sort of kind of recourses did they have?
Yeah, it's an important question because, of course, members of the free black community in cities like Philadelphia, and your listeners may know that Philadelphia has one of the largest and certainly the most dynamic free black communities in the early United States by the 1820s with several thousand people. Members of the free black community in cities like Philadelphia are well aware that these abductions, these predations, these kidnappings are going on because they've been going on for years. So we know that parents are giving their children the 19th century equivalent of the talk to warn them about how to handle themselves when they're out in the world, how to handle themselves around strangers, people that make them offers which seem too good to be true. So parents are doing all they can to try to inoculate and protect their children from these predations, but their parents still have to work and go out every day and earn money, and they can't be supervising their children 24/7. Many of the children themselves, of course, some are in school, if they're fortunate. Though places in schools for black children are few and far between. Some more are in employment, and they have to walk to work every day. Some of the boys in my story, two of the five boys, are chimney sweeps, for instance. That still leaves a lot of opportunity, unfortunately. And one of the, I hope, big take-homes of the first chapters of this book, Stolen, is that the freedom of African-American people, whether they be adults or children, the freedom of lawfully free people in states like Pennsylvania is exceedingly tenuous. It's fragile. Erica Dunbar, her first book was called Fragile Freedom, and it's about the free black community in Philadelphia. And that idea that one can be legally free, but that freedom can be constantly in the balance, can be constantly subjected to discrimination in the housing market, discrimination in the labor market, but also snatched away by kidnappers who cross into Pennsylvania from places like Maryland and Delaware, was achingly apparent to every member of the free black community. So when kidnappings occurred, Derek, there were very limited options for people involved. The victims themselves, of course, could and did try to resist their kidnapping, kicking and screaming, yelling and biting, anything they could do to draw attention to the fact that they're being abducted. But in many cases, that was insufficient to draw attention quickly. When parents realize their children have disappeared and conclude that kidnapping rather than truancy or staying at a friend's house or running away from home is the cause. Parents also have limited options. The African-American community does not have much political capital in cities like Philadelphia in the 19th century. They are, as I've said, the victims of racial discrimination in the housing market, the labor market, and in other spheres. They do not have many political allies in the state legislature, in city government. The police, the constables don't make much time for them. In fact, they're more willing to turn a blind eye sometimes when kidnappers strike. So what we do find is that Black mothers and fathers, when this happens to their child, will try to make a beeline for the nearest member of the one anti-slavery society in town. It's called the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, or the PAS. Its officers, the members of its acting committee, were widely known as the only likely allies among people of influence in Philadelphia that Black parents could turn to. And so we have story after story in the PAS case files of a white lawyer, a white Quaker, a white merchant who was a member of the acting committee of the PAS trying to enjoy their dinner when there's a knock on the door. And it's a Black person, often a mother, in tears and distraught, doing everything they can to get this person to ignore their dinner and come with them down to the docks and do something to try to initiate an investigation, start a rescue, some sort of interception to get their child, their son or daughter back, who might have disappeared 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago.
And one of the things that I found most interesting about your book was your discussion of, at least in this particular case and with this, you know, particular gang that you said is, you know, sort of the biggest, most organized gang out there, that the region in which they operate in is particularly advantageous for them. And so when we're thinking about that, what sort of factors made this region of the country easier to operate in as an illicit slave trader?
Yeah, there's a few answers to that. I'll try and run through them pretty quick. So we're talking here about Eastern Pennsylvania, that my five boys go missing from the streets of Philadelphia. And the kidnappers who abduct them take them first to the eastern shore of Maryland near the Delaware line, so the Delmarva Peninsula more broadly. And they warehouse them there for about a week, I think it is, before then shipping them out across the Chesapeake Bay to Virginia and then marching them across the continent towards Mississippi and Alabama. But it's striking that they try to rush them out of Pennsylvania and into Maryland and Delaware as quickly as possible. As your listeners may know, by 1825, slavery in Pennsylvania is on its very, very last legs. There's been a gradual abolition act passed in Pennsylvania back in 1780, which over the course of 20, 30, 40 years did exactly what it promised, which is gradually abolish slavery in Pennsylvania. It literally took decades, but it did get the job done. So by 1825, Pennsylvania is effectively a free state, which is why the city of Philadelphia is home to such a large and dynamic free Black population. But if we go just a couple of dozen miles south of Pennsylvania, then we find ourselves in Maryland, we find ourselves in Delaware, two slave states where there have not been significant anti-slavery acts of legislation. And slavery is still very much a going concern. Plantation owners in those two states have long since made the transition away from tobacco cultivation towards the cultivation of wheat and corn and other cereals, which are far less labor intensive, but still require a slave labor force in their minds. So on the Eastern Shore, this is an agricultural settlement where the elite white members of society are still slaveholders, where there's still a significant enslaved population, which is to say, it's the sort of place, it's the sort of climate where a kidnapping gang like the Cannon Johnson gang can set up its headquarters and feel relatively safe, relatively protected, protected by a legal regime, by a political elite, which is not terribly interested in pursuing allegations of kidnapping against its own white residents. So this gang uses the Delmarva Peninsula for a literal and figurative safe house and warehouse for those free black adults and more likely children that they kidnap out of Philadelphia, across the Freedom Line, across the color line, into the slave states before they figure out what to do with them or where to sell them.
And when we're talking about, you know, this whole process of the interstate slave trade, both the sort of the legal slave trade that goes on mostly in the South, but then there's also this illicit slave trade that you are speaking of, what sort of factors led to an increase in this movement and this trading that you are able to see? And then when we're talking about the actual journey south that these boys take and that, you know, hundreds of thousands of other enslaved black people and free black people as well are taking, what is that journey like?
Yeah, so you might have to remind me of that second question because I can only keep one question in my head at a time. But let's take that first question you asked about what is new about all this in the 19th century. And two things are new. Two things, I think, explain the rise of the large and legal domestic slave trade and the simultaneous rise of the smaller and wholly illegal reverse underground railroad. The first is an act of law passed in 1806 that goes into effect on January the 1st, 1808, whereby the Jefferson administration outlaws the further legal importation of enslaved people from outside the United States. So it, after 1808, it's no longer legal or lawful to bring in enslaved people directly from Africa or via the Caribbean. We could say this is the end of the transatlantic slave trade so far as it concerns the United States, though smuggling, as you might imagine, does continue. So that change in the law, which occurs for many reasons, has the effect that if you want to grow the enslaved population in the United States overall, or more likely, if you want to move to a newly established state like Mississippi and Alabama, and you want to bring slaves with you or buy slaves, then you have to look for sources within the United States. So as we see the Louisiana Purchase, as we see various treaties with Indians and the Spanish along the southern border, we see the carving out of new territories and eventually new states, which fill with American, with white American settlers, many of whom decide they want to plant sugar or cotton there. And again, I'm thinking about the states around the Gulf South when I say this. And those white settlers decide that if they're going to plant sugar, if they're going to plant cotton, then they're going to need large numbers of enslaved people to do that. They can no longer buy enslaved people from overseas, so they need to buy them from suppliers within the United States. So that is why we see after 1808 a huge reorganization of the American slave market to funnel massive numbers of enslaved people from upper South slave states like Delaware, like Maryland, like Virginia, who planters there regard as unprofitable or surplus, to masters setting up in the new cotton kingdom in the Deep South. So this is the rise of the domestic slave trade, which is, again, it's wholly legal. Planters in the Upper South sell slaves they no longer want to pay to care for to slave traders. The slave traders transfer them, transport them either over land or by sea or by river and occasionally by rail to places like Natchez, Mobile, New Orleans, etc., where those enslaved folks are sold to planters setting up in the Cotton Kingdom. And we see criminal traffickers take advantage of that obviously massive demand for enslaved laborers in the Deep South. Criminal traffickers like Paddy Cannon and Joseph Johnson believe that there is sufficient demand that certain planters won't ask too many questions about where the enslaved laborers their gang presents them with are from, or that if they are cognizant of the illicit way in which enslaved laborers were abducted into slavery, that if gang members give planters a sufficient discount, they will buy them anyway.
And then what does this sort of this journey look like for enslaved people and the free black people who are involved?
So this is an important question. And historically, in terms of scholarship, it's been quite difficult to gain access to that experience. Whether we're talking about the experience of legally traded slaves from Virginia to Mississippi or kidnapped children like the five boys I write about in Stolen, and what their experience is marching across, trudging across, walking across this great country were like, we have precious few accounts written by people who made that journey. And so historians who've tackled the domestic slave trade, and there are several, have often focused on the legal dimensions of it, different laws, different economic changes, or what we can say about the aggregate experiences, rather than boring down to recover individual experiences. And one of the things I try to do in Stolen is to push that a little bit, to try to recover over the course of two chapters at the heart of the book what these five boys' experience was like walking from eastern Virginia when they crossed the Chesapeake Bay from the eastern shore, from eastern Virginia down first to Alabama and then to Mississippi. This is a monstrous distance. And the older boys did this journey on foot. I think that's about 2 million steps. I think it took several months, 4 months, around there. And so we can make guesses about roughly how far they walked every day. We know from travelers' accounts who saw other slave coffles on the road and from a few rare business records kept by legal traders what sort of provisions for food and clothing and shelter and transportation coffles like this one would have been provided with by the captors. We know something about the psychological dimensions of this journey as well, because this was an ordeal like nothing these free boys had ever experienced before, obviously. So in the book, I try to reconstruct that in as much detail as I can to make readers understand, help readers understand that for five free black boys from Philadelphia, some of whom may not have seen the ocean before or set foot outside of Pennsylvania or even Philadelphia before, this was a incredibly long, incredibly taxing, atomizing, and alienating experience, which probably left them with a lot of unprocessed trauma to live with subsequently.
And, you know, our listeners will probably pick up by now that we're not talking a lot about details of this particular journey. And that's because I want all of y'all to go out and actually buy and read this book. However, you know, some of the things that you talk about in here are just too good not to ask you about. And so one of the things that I found particularly interesting is how one instance where there's an attempt to run away. And this happens within Choctaw Country. And one of the things I find interesting is the sort of reception that enslaved, in this case, free black fugitives, fugitive slaves receive within Choctaw Country. And so can you speak a little bit about, you know, how do Native Americans play into this story, and what sort of role and kind of maybe even conundrum are they placed in their kind of particular places within the South?
Yes, thank you. So just to be clear, yes, the five boys who were kidnapped into slavery in August 1825 do not go quietly. They resist at various points in this story, and this story is structured around, built out of their attempts to resist their kidnapping and enslavement. And one of the most important instances of that is the one you just referred to, when one of the five boys, his name is Sam, he's about 15 years old, he runs away from the coffle and from his captors in Alabama, which is touching Choctaw country, the territory controlled and occupied by the Choctaw Indians. And we don't know how much he knew or didn't know or guessed or surmised about whether Choctaw Indians would be a safe harbor receptive to a slave fugitive. But we can know that he was one of hundreds of enslaved people on these journeys through the Lower South who did try to run to Native American groups for safety and protection in the first several decades of the 19th century. And scholars like Natalie Joy have pointed out that in the early decades after the American Revolution, say from about 1780 to about 1810, more often than not, Native American groups were likely to give protection and harbor and comfort and material aid to runaway slaves. We could regard them as sort of being anti-slavery allies if we wanted to push it in that direction. But as I write in the book, things had changed by 1825. The number of white American settlers pushing onto Native American land in this area was continuing to grow. Treaties were being discarded by these and ignored by these white settlers. There was a sense among the Choctaws and other southern Indian groups like them that they were living under siege. And for better or worse, the response, the political response that the Choctaws come up with is what I characterize as appeasement, which is to try to figure out how to coexist with swarming white settlers, how to get into the good graces of state legislatures in places like Alabama and the federal legislature in Washington. So we see a program of reforms amongst the Choctaws, which sees them try to live in more explicitly European-American ways. We see changes to their agriculture to try to imitate American land use white American land use practices. We see changes to their anti-slavery position, where it becomes more and more likely that a Choctaw warrior, when confronted in the woods with a runaway slave, will not take them in, but will march them back to where they came from and claim a reward. And unfortunately, this is the story of what happens when Sam runs into Choctaw country in November 1825. A Choctaw warrior meets him in the woods and, instead of giving him sanctuary, marches him back to the coffle captors from which he tried to escape, and they beat him within an inch of his life.
And, you know, once we get past the coffle, once these boys are finally sold in the South, you point out something that is very unlikely to happen, but nonetheless does happen in this case, where the boys try and tell the people who are buying them that they're free, which is not uncommon. But what is slightly uncommon, as you point out, is that they're actually listened to. And so basically, as you say, you know, there's this effort to actually return the boys. And so why would that happen? You know, as you mentioned earlier, most of the people who would be buying from illicit traders just don't care whether or not the people are actually free or legally enslaved. And so why would some white Southerners actually try and return these boys and actually not want to keep free people as enslaved people?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't want to say too much about the specific characters or events in the book at this point in the story, because what does happen is so unusual and unexpected. I want readers to discover that for themselves. But I'll talk in general terms and say that, of course, the very prosperity of operators of the reverse Underground Railroad, the very business plan of kidnappers like Patty Cannon, Joe Johnson, and other members of the gang, relies on the expectation that there will be plenty of buyers in the Deep South who won't know, or much more likely won't care, that the people they're being offered to buy are in fact legally free people from Philadelphia or places like it. That's how the system is supposed to work. So when it doesn't work like that, it's probably because of the confluence of an unusual set of circumstances and personalities and characters. We've got to recognize, of course, the role that the victims of this human trafficking network play in drawing attention to their illegal captivity. We see time and again that people kidnapped into the reverse Underground Railroad speak up as often as they can at any opportunity they can get to tell owners, buyers, traders, bystanders, tavern keepers they meet along the way that they are free, that they've been kidnapped, that they must be returned, that this is wrong. And so without that activism, because that's what it is, then no one would ever shake loose of the reverse Underground Railroad. But we might also think in general terms about why some white Southerners might not want to be seen to be actively participating or condoning or endorsing the trade in kidnapped free children. The domestic slave trade, its larger legal equivalent, is starting to come under significant political attack by anti-slavery activists in northern cities by the 1820s. Boosters or defenders of the legal and lawful domestic slave trade are trying to protect its reputation as best they can, trying to argue that it is clean, that conditions are good, that it is economically necessary, that families are never, never, never separated, which of course is a lie. The stain and stink caused by the apparent association between the legal domestic slave trade and the kidnapping traffic of free black children is a huge PR problem for slave owners generally. It's also a moral problem, obviously, as well. And arguably, it's a legal problem in some southern jurisdictions as well, which all have anti-kidnapping laws on the books. So you might see a confluence of circumstances where certain slavery stakeholders might try and draw a line between the lawful and legal domestic slave trade, which they want to protect, and the illegal and immoral and abhorrent trade in kidnapped children, which they see as staining the larger traffic they want to protect.
And, you know, you were just mentioning, you know, how the abolitionist and anti-slavery movement is picking up during this time, and, you know, how Southerners might try and, you know, do this only to kind of protect the institution of slavery as a whole. And so if we're thinking about both of those things and happening together and everything like that, how does this situation, you know, this kidnapping and then the eventual, you know, returning of these boys to the North, how does that all play out in the abolitionist movement? How does the movement kind of get influenced by this particular instance?
Yeah. So again, I want to be a little bit purposefully vague, and I apologize for that. But I will say that this particular case proves to be incredibly, to use a word I hate, impactful, by which I mean it receives a lot of press coverage in Philadelphia when it happens, the absence, the disappearance of these five boys. That's in part due to the activism of their parents and loved ones that they've been snatched away from. It's in part due to the direct involvement of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, the PAS, and it's in part due to the eventual involvement of the mayor of Philadelphia, who, unlike many other mayors of Philadelphia before and since, was far more sensitive to the duty to protect the free black residents of his city. So the case draws a lot of attention, and it is such is regarded as such an outrage in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania more broadly that it triggers a legal change. It triggers a new set of anti-kidnapping laws, which go into effect in 1826, a year later. Those kidnapping laws are eventually challenged in the Supreme Court of the United States in 1842 in a case called Prigg versus Pennsylvania. In a series of responses to that case, we end up with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 and the Compromise of 1850, which I think most historians would tell you is perhaps the most significant political development on the march to civil war. Now, I am not here to tell you that the kidnapping case I write about causes the civil war, that it would be massive hyperbole, but there's a series of connections which get us from this kidnapping to one law, to one Supreme Court case, to the Compromise of 1850, which I want readers to understand. I want readers to understand how the furor around kidnapping and around kidnapping, this kidnapping in particular, does cause a series of reactions, political, legal, and activist, which shake the United States in different ways. I'd also say one more thing, which is that within the anti-slavery movement, which, as you pointed out, is growing and rising and changing and becoming bolder and more extreme in the 1820s and 1830s and 1840s, the kidnapping of free black children into slavery becomes something of a cause celebre, something of a focus and fixation for white and black activists to rally around, to point at and say, hey, you white Northerners who think just because you've abolished slavery in Massachusetts, in Connecticut, in New York, in Pennsylvania, that you guys are now blameless and that your job is done. No, wake up. Black people are still being stolen from under your noses. Black families are being forcibly separated. Slave traffickers are coming into our free states from slave states like Maryland and Delaware and further south and making a mockery of our personal liberty laws designed to protect the legal liberty of free African Americans from seizure. Get off your couches and do something. So in their moral suasion output, in their anti-slavery propaganda, which is pumping out of anti-slavery presses at ever more impressive restless rates by the 1830s and 40s, the focus on the kidnapping of free black people and of free black children most especially is completely unmistakable. And the figure of the suffering black child separated forcibly from its mother becomes arguably the defining trope of the anti-slavery movement by the 1840s. So if you're looking for the origins of that focus, that fetishization of the trope of the suffering black child, then I would argue that the kidnapping case, which causes such a stir in Philadelphia in 1825, is a significant point of origin for that trajectory.
And so before we let you go, you know, we have this great book in front of us. Once again, you know, it's Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Journey Home. And with any luck, this podcast will be going up either the day of or very shortly after it is published, which it will be October 15th. And, you know, our listeners, you know, as we've said before to y'all, we're kind of being a little bit tongue in cheek here. We don't want to give you all the details. Go out and read the book, buy the book. It's honestly, as the title says, an astonishing tale of what's going on. I guarantee you learning the history behind what's going on right now is not going to give you all of what's going on in the book, the actual story. And so we have this book in front of us right now. What can we expect from you in the future? What might you be working on next? And obviously, it's completely okay to say nothing. I just wrote a book. I don't know what I want to do right now.
I would say that, first of all, that I have just written a book and I'm spending a lot of time talking with public audiences around the country about this story and why it matters, because it does matter. This is an important story. And it resonates, I think. I hope it resonates with the times we're living through now, where children still get ripped away from their parents brutally and unexpectedly, where people who don't have their papers, people who are poor, people who are undocumented, people of color, still have to fear that the freedom they have is desperately fragile. So I hope to be talking about this for a while because it's important. But I'm also at work on two other projects. One is a large-scale history of the railroads in as they relate to slavery and anti-slavery, how the railroads spread American slavery in the 1840s and 1850s, and how anti-slavery activists and fugitives use the railroad, not the figurative, metaphorical underground railroad, but the actual railroads that latticed this country together by the 1840s and 50s. So I'm starting to work on that big project, and I'm also starting to work on a much smaller, narrower human scale project about someone called Elizabeth Jennings, who in 1854 refused to follow the segregated transportation policies of how to get onto a tram or a trolley in New York, and like Rosa Parks a century later, refused to be told where she could and could not sit. And her protest, a political protest, in 1850s New York, led to a larger attempt to try to desegregate public transportation in that city. And I'd like to really delve into that story in much greater depth than historians have so far been able to do.
Well, I'm sure once those are done, we'll probably have you right back onto the program to speak about those. But in the meantime, Dr. Bell, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
Derek, thanks so much.